face of Sergeant Doakes looked out at me, like an idol for some wicked god, carved from a piece of dark wood.
"Why you leaving work in the middle of the day so much lately?"
he asked me. His voice had no real expression in it, but still managed to give the impression that whatever I said would be a lie, and he would like to hurt me for it.
"Why, Sergeant Doakes," I said cheerfully, "what an amazing coincidence. What are you doing here?"
"You got something to do more important than your job?" he said. He really seemed uninterested in maintaining any sort of flow in the conversation, so I shrugged.
When faced with people who have very limited conversational skills and no apparent desire to cultivate any, it's always easier simply to go along.
I had some personal things to take care of," I said.
Very weak, I agree. But Doakes displayed an unnerving habit of asking the most awkward questions, and with such an understated viciousness that I found it hard enough not to stutter, let alone come up with something clever.
He looked at me for several endless seconds, the way a starving pit bull looks at raw meat.
"Personal things," he said without blinking.
It sounded even stupider when he repeated it.
"That's right," I said.
"Your dentist is over in the Gables," he said.
"Well,
your doctor, too, over on Alameda. Got no lawyer, sister still at work," he said. "What kind of personal things did I leave out?"
"Actually, I said, and was amazed to hear myself stammer. But nothing else came out, and Doakes just looked at me as though he was begging me to make a run for it so he could practice his wing shot.
"Funny," he said at last. "I got personal things to do out here, too."
"Really?" I said, relieved to find that my mouth was once again capable of forming human speech. "And what would that be, Sergeant?"
It was the first time I had ever seen him smile, and I have to say that I would have greatly preferred it if he had simply jumped out of the car and bitten me.
"I'm watching you," he said.
He gave me a moment to admire the high gloss of his teeth, and then the window rolled up, and he vanished behind the tinted glass like the Cheshire Cat. Chapter 5. Given enough time, I'm sure I could come up with an entire list of things more unpleasant than having Sergeant Doakes turn into my own personal shadow. But as I stood there in my high-fashion foul-weather gear and thought of Riker and his red boots slipping away from me, it seemed bad enough, and I wasn't inspired to think of anything worse. I simply climbed into my car, started the engine, and drove through the rain to my apartment. Ordinarily, the homicidal antics of the other drivers would have comforted me, made me feel right at home. But for some reason, the maroon Taurus following so close behind took away the glow. I knew Sergeant Doakes well enough to know that this was not simply a rainy day whim on his part. If he was watching me, he would keep watching me until he caught me doing something naughty, or until he was unable to watch me anymore. Naturally enough, I could readily think of a few intriguing ways to make sure he lost interest, but they were all so permanent. And while I didn't actually have a conscience, I did have a very clear set of rules that worked somewhat the same way. I had known that sooner or later, Sergeant Doakes would do something or other to discourage my hobby, and I had thought long and hard about what to do when he did. The best I had come up with, alas, was wait and see.
"Excuse me?" you might say. "And you have every right.
Can we truly ignore the obvious answer here? After all, Doakes might be strong and lethal, but the dark passenger was much more so, and no one could stand against him when he took the wheel.
Perhaps just this once."
"No,"
said the small, soft voice in my ear.
"Hello, Harry."
"Why not?"
And as I asked,
I thought back to the time he had told me.
There are rules, Dexter, Harry had said.
Rules, Dad?
This ends Disc 1. Dearly Devoted Dexter, Disc 2.
It was my 16th birthday. There was never much of a party, since I hadn't yet learned to be wonderfully charming and chummy. And if I wasn't avoiding my drooling contemporaries, then they were generally avoiding me. I lived my adolescence like a sheepdog moving through a flock of dirty, very stupid sheep. Since then, I had learned a great deal. For example, I wasn't that far off at 16. People really are hopeless, but it just doesn't do to let on. So my 16th birthday was a rather restrained affair. Doris, my foster mom, had recently died of cancer, but my foster sister, Deborah, made me a cake, and Harry gave me a new fishing rod. I blew out the candles, we ate the cake, and then Harry took me into the backyard of our modest Coconut Grove house. He sat at the redwood picnic table that he had built by the brick barbecue oven and motioned me to sit, too.
"Well, Dex," he said, 16. You're almost a man."
I wasn't sure what that was supposed to mean. Me? A man? As in human? And I didn't know what sort of response was expected of me. But I did know that it was usually best not to make clever remarks with Harry. So I just nodded. And Harry gave me a blue-eyed X-ray.
"Are you interested in girls at all?" he asked me.
In what way?" I said.
"Kissing, making out, you know, sex."
My head whirled at the thought, as though a cold, dark foot were kicking at the inside of my forehead.
I said, silver-tongued even then.
"Not like that." Harry nodded, as if that made sense.
"Not boys, though," he said,
and I just shook my head. Harry looked at the table, then back at the house.
"When I turned 16, my father took me to a whore."
He shook his head, and a very small smile flickered across his face.
"It took me 10 years to get over that."
I could think of absolutely nothing to say to that. The idea of sex was completely alien to me, and to think of paying for it, especially for your child, and when that child was Harry, well, really, it was all too much. I looked at Harry with something close to panic, and he smiled.
"No," said Harry, "I wasn't going to offer. I expect you'll get more use out of that fishing rod."
He shook his head slowly and looked away, far out over the picnic table, across the yard, down the street.
"Or a fillet knife."
"Yes," I said, trying not to sound too eager.
"No," he said again. "We both know what you want, but you're not ready."
Since the first time Harry had talked to me about what I was, on a memorable camping trip several years ago, we'd been getting me ready. Getting me, in Harry's words, squared away. As a mutton-headed young artificial human, I was eager to get started on my happy career. But Harry held me back, because Harry always knew. "I can be careful," I said.
"But not perfect," he said. "There are rules, Dexter. There have to be. That's what separates you from the other ones."
"Blend in," I said. "Clean up. Don't take chances. Harry shook his head.
"More important, you have to be sure before you start that this person really deserves it. I can't tell you the number of times I knew somebody was guilty and I had to let them go. To have the bastard look at you and smirk, and you know, and he knows, but you have to hold the door for him and let him go."
He clenched his jaw and tapped a fist on the picnic table.
you won't have to. But you have to be sure. Dead sure, Dexter. And even if you're absolutely positive...
He held his hand up in the air, palm facing me.
Get some proof. It doesn't have to hold up in court, thank God.
He gave a small and bitter laugh.
You'd never get anywhere. But you need proof, Dexter. That's the most important thing.
He tapped the table with his knuckle.
You have to have proof. And even then...
He stopped. An uncharacteristic hairy pause. And I waited, knowing something difficult was coming.
Sometimes, even then, you let them go. No matter how much they deserve it. If they're too conspicuous, for example. If it would raise too much attention, let it go.
Well, there it was. As always, Harry had the answer for me. Whenever I was unsure, I could hear Harry whispering in my ear. I was sure, but I had no proof that Doakes was anything except a very angry and suspicious cop, and chopping up a cop was certainly the sort of thing the city got indignant about. After the recent untimely demise of Detective LaGuerta, the police hierarchy would almost certainly be a little sensitive about a second cop going out in the same way. No matter how necessary it seemed, Doakes was out of bounds for me. I could look out the window at the maroon Taurus nosed under a tree, but I could do nothing about it except wish for some other solution to spontaneously arise. For example, a piano falling on his head. Sadly enough, I was left hoping for luck. But there was no luck tonight for poor, disappointed Dexter. And lately, there had been a tragic lack of falling pianos in the Miami area. So here I was in my little hovel, pacing the floor with frustration, and every time I casually peeked out the window, there was the Taurus parked across the way. The memory of what I had been so happily contemplating only an hour ago pounded in my head. Can Dexter come out and play? Alas, no, dear dark passenger. Dexter is in time out. There was, however, one constructive thing I could do, even cooped up in my apartment. I took the crumpled piece of paper from McGregor's boat out of my pocket and smoothed it out, which left my fingers sticky from the leftover gunk off the roll of duct tape to which the paper had been stuck. Riker, and a phone number. More than enough to feed to one of the reverse directories I could access from my computer. And in just a few minutes, I had done so. The number belonged to a cell phone, which was registered to a Mr. Steve Riker of Tiger Tail Avenue in Coconut Grove. A little bit of cross-checking revealed that Mr. Riker was a professional photographer. Of course, it could have been a coincidence. I am sure that there are many people named Riker around the world who are photographers. I looked in the yellow pages and found that this particular Riker had a specialty. He had a quarter-page ad that said, "Remember them as they are now." Riker specialized in pictures of children. The coincidence theory might have to go. The dark passenger stirred and gave a small chuckle of anticipation, and I found myself planning a trip over to Tiger Tail for a quick look around. In fact, it wasn't terribly far away. I could drive over now and let Sergeant Doakes follow along, playing pin the tail on the Dexter. Splendid idea, old chum. That would save Doakes a great deal of boring investigative work when Riker finally disappeared someday. He could cut through all the dull routine and just come get me. And at this rate, when would Riker disappear? It was terribly frustrating to have a worthwhile goal in sight, and yet to be held in check like this. But after several hours, Doakes was still parked across the street, and I was still here. What to do? On the plus side, it seemed obvious that Doakes had not seen enough to take any action beyond following me. But leading the way in the very large minus column, if he continued to follow me, I would be forced to stay in character as the mild-mannered forensic lab rat, carefully avoiding anything more lethal than rush hour on the Palmetto Expressway. That would never do. I felt a certain pressure, not just from the passenger, but from the clock. Before too much time passed, I needed to find some proof that Riker was the photographer who took McGregor's pictures, and if he was, have a sharp and pointed chat with him. If he realized McGregor had gone the way of all flesh, he would most likely run for the hills. And if my associates at police headquarters realized it, things could get very uncomfortable for dashing Dexter. But Doakes had apparently settled in for a long stay, and at the moment there was nothing I could do about it. It was terribly frustrating to think of Riker walking around instead of thrashing against the duct tape. Homicidus interruptus. A soft moan and a gnashing of mental teeth came from the dark passenger, and I knew just how he felt. But there seemed to be very little I could do except pace back and forth. And even that wasn't very helpful. If I kept it up, I would wear a hole in the carpet, and then I would never get back my security deposit on the apartment. My instinct was to do something that would throw Doakes off the track, but he was no ordinary bloodhound. I could think of only one thing that might take the scent out of his quivering, eager snout. It was just barely possible that I could wear him down, playing the waiting game, be relentlessly normal for so long that he would have to give it up, and return to his real job of catching all the truly horrible residents on the underside of our fair city. Why, even now, they were out there double parking, littering, and threatening to vote Democratic in the next election. How could he waste his time on little old Dexter and his harmless hobby? All right, then. I would be unstintingly ordinary until it made his teeth hurt. It might take weeks rather than days, but I would do it. I would live fully the synthetic life I had created in order to appear human. And since humans are generally ruled by sex, I would start with a visit to my girlfriend, Rita. It's an odd term, girlfriend, particularly for grown persons, and in practice, an even odder concept. Generally speaking, in adults, it described a woman, not a girl, who was willing to provide sex, not friendship. In fact, from what I had observed, it was quite possible for one to actively dislike one's girlfriend. Although, of course, true hatred is reserved for marriage. I had so far been unable to determine what women expect in return from a boyfriend, but apparently I had it, as far as Rita was concerned. It certainly wasn't sex, which to me seemed about as interesting as calculating foreign trade deficits. Luckily, Rita also was uninterested in sex, for the most part. She was the product of a disastrous early marriage to a man whose idea of a good time turned out to be smoking crack and beating her. Later, he branched out into infecting her with several intriguing diseases. But when he battered the kids one night, Rita's marvelous country song loyalty ruptured, and she flung the swine out of her life, and happily into prison. As a result of all this turmoil, she had been looking for a gentleman who might be interested in companionship and conversation, someone who didn't need to indulge the crude animal urges of base passion, a man, in other words, who would value her for her finer qualities and not her willingness to indulge in naked acrobatics. H.A. Dexter. For 2 years, she had been my ideal disguise, a key ingredient of Dexter as the world at large knew him. And in return, I had not beaten her, had not infected her with anything, had not forced my animal lust on her. And she actually seemed to enjoy my company.
And, as a bonus, I had become quite fond of her children, Aster and Cody. Strange, perhaps, but nonetheless true, I assure you. If everyone else in the world were to mysteriously disappear, I would feel irritated about it, only because there would be no one to make me donuts. But children are interesting to me, and, in fact, I like them. Rita's two kids had been through a traumatic early childhood, and maybe because I had two, I felt a special attachment to them, an interest that went beyond maintaining my disguise with Rita. Aside from the bonus of her children, Rita herself was quite presentable. She had short and neat blonde hair, a trim and athletic body, and she seldom said things that were outright stupid. I could go in public with her and know that we looked like an appropriately matched human pair, which was really the whole point. People even said we were an attractive couple, although I was never sure what that meant. I suppose Rita found me attractive somehow, although her track record with men didn't make that too flattering. Still, it's always nice to be around someone who thinks I am wonderful. It confirms my low opinion of people. I looked at the clock on my desk. 5:32. Within the next 15 minutes, Rita would be home from her job at Fairchild Title Agency, where she did something very complicated involving fractions of percentage points. By the time I got to her house, she should be there. With a cheerful, synthetic smile, I headed out the door, waved to Doakes, and drove over to Rita's modest South Miami house. The traffic wasn't too bad, which is to say that there were no fatal accidents or shootings, and in just under 20 minutes, I parked my car in front of Rita's bungalow. Sergeant Doakes cruised past to the end of the street, and, as I knocked on the front door, he parked across the way. The door swung open, and Rita peered out at me. "Oh," she said. "Dexter." "In person," I said. "I was in the neighborhood and wondered if you were home yet." "Well, I just walked in the door. I must look like a mess. Come on in. Would you like a beer?" Beer. What a thought. I never touched the stuff, and yet it was so amazingly normal, so perfectly visit the girlfriend after work. Even Doakes had to be impressed. It was just the right touch. "I would love a beer," I said, and I followed her into the relative cool of the living room. "Have a seat," she said. "I'm just going to freshen up a little." She smiled at me. "The kids are out back, but I'm sure they'll be all over you when they find out you're here." And she swished off down the hall, returning a moment later with a can of beer. "I'll be right back," she said, and went away to her bedroom at the back of the house. I sat on the sofa and looked at the beer in my hand. I am not a drinker. Really, drinking is not a recommended habit for predators. It slows the reflexes, dulls the perceptions, and knits up the raveled sleeve of care, which always sounded to me like a very bad thing. But here I was, a demon on vacation, attempting the ultimate sacrifice by giving up my powers and becoming human. And so, a beer was just the thing for dipsophobic Dexter. I took a sip. The taste was bitter and thin, just as I would be if I had to keep the dark passenger buckled into his seatbelt for very long. Still, I suppose beer is an acquired taste. I took another sip. I could feel it gurgle all the way down and splash into my stomach. And it occurred to me that with all the excitement and frustration of the day, I hadn't eaten lunch. But what the hell? It was just a light beer, or as the can proudly proclaimed, L-I-T-E beer. I suppose we should be very grateful they hadn't thought of a cuter way to spell beer. I took a big sip. It wasn't that bad when you got used to it. By golly,
It really was relaxing. I, at any rate, felt more relaxed with each swig. Another refreshing sip. I couldn't remember that it had tasted this good when I tried it in college. Of course, I was just a boy then, not the manly, mature, hard-working, upright citizen I was now. I tilted the can, but nothing came out. Well, somehow the can was empty, and yet I was still thirsty. Could this unpleasant situation really be tolerated? I thought not. Absolutely intolerable. In fact, I didn't plan to tolerate it. I stood up and proceeded to the kitchen in a firm and unyielding manner. There were several more cans of light beer in the refrigerator, and I took one back to the couch. I sat. I opened the beer. I took a sip. Much better. Damn that Dokes, anyway. Maybe I should take him a beer. It might relax him, get him to loosen up and call the whole thing off. After all, we were on the same side, weren't we? I sipped. Rita came back wearing a pair of denim shorts and a white tank top with a tiny satin bow at the neckline. I had to admit, she looked very nice. I could really pick a disguise. "Well," she said as she slid onto the couch next to me, "it's nice to see you, out of the blue like this." "It certainly must be," I said. She cocked her head to one side and looked at me funny. "Did you have a hard day at work?" "An awful day," I said, and took a big sip. "Had to let a bad guy go. Very bad guy."
"Oh," she frowned. Couldn't you just..."
"I wanted to just," I said, "but I couldn't." I raised the beer can to her. "Politics." I took a sip. Rita shook her head.
"I still can't get used to the idea that from the outside it seems so cut and dried. You find the bad guy, you put him away. But politics? What did he do?"
"He helped to kill some kids," I said.
"Oh," she said, and looked shocked. "My God, there must be something you can do."
I smiled at her. By gum, she had seen it right away. What a gal. "Didn't I say I could pick 'em?" "You have put your finger right on it," I said, and I took her hand to look at that finger. "There is something I can do, and very well, too." I patted her hand, spilling only a little bit of beer. "I knew you'd understand." She looked confused.
"Oh," she said. "What will you do?"
I took a sip.
"Why shouldn't I tell her?
I could see she already got the idea."
"Why not?"
I opened my mouth, but before I could whisper even one syllable about the dark passenger and my harmless hobby, Cody and Aster came racing into the room, stopped dead when they saw me, and stood there, looking from me to their mother.
"Hi, Dexter," Aster said. She nudged her brother.
"Hi," he said softly.
He was not a big talker. In fact, he never said much of anything. Poor kid. The whole thing with his father had really messed him up.
"Are you drunk?" he asked me.
It was a big speech for him.
"Cody," Rita said.
I waved her off bravely and faced him.
"Drunk?" I said. "Me?"
He nodded.
"Yeah."
"Certainly not," I said firmly, giving him my very best dignified frown. "Possibly a little bit tipsy, but that's not the same thing at all."
"Oh," he said.
And his sister chimed in.
"Are you staying for dinner?"
"Oh, I think I should probably be going," I said. But Rita put a surprisingly firm hand on my shoulder.
"You're not driving anywhere like this," she said.
"Like what?"
"Tipsy," said Cody.
"I'm not tipsy," I said.
"You said you were,"
said Cody. I couldn't remember the last time I'd heard him put four words in a row like that, and I was very proud of him.
You did, Aster added. You said you're not drunk. You're just a little tipsy.
I said that? They both nodded. Oh, well then.
Well then, Rita chimed in, I guess you're staying for dinner.
Well then, I guess I did. I'm pretty sure I did, anyway. I do know that at some point I went to the refrigerator for a light beer and discovered they were all gone. And at some later point, I was sitting on the couch again. The television was on, and I was trying to figure out what the actors were saying and why an invisible crowd thought it was the most hilarious dialogue of all time.
Rita slid onto the couch next to me. The kids are in bed, she said. How do you feel?
I feel wonderful, I said. If only I could figure out what's so funny.
Rita put a hand on my shoulder. It really bothers you, doesn't it? Letting the bad guy go? Children?
She moved closer and put her arm all the way around me, laying her head on my shoulder.
You're such a good guy, Dexter.
No, I'm not, I said, wondering why she would say something so very strange. Rita sat up and looked from my left eye to my right eye and back again.
But you are. You know you are.
She smiled and nestled her head back down on my shoulder.
I think it's nice that you came here to see me when you were feeling bad.
I started to tell her that wasn't quite right. But then it occurred to me I had come here when I felt bad. True, it was only to bore Dokes into going away, after the terrible frustration of losing my playdate with Riker. But it had turned out to be a pretty good idea after all, hadn't it?
Good old Rita. She was very warm, and she smelled nice.
Good old Rita, I said. I pulled her against me as tight as I could, and leaned my cheek against the top of her head. We sat that way for a few minutes, and then Rita wiggled to her feet and pulled me up by the hand.
Come on, she said. Let's get you to bed.
Which we did. And when I had flopped down under the top sheet and she crawled in beside me, she was just so nice and smelled so good and felt so warm and comfortable that... Well, beer really is amazing stuff. Isn't it? Chapter 6. I woke up with a headache, a feeling of tremendous self-loathing, and a sense of disorientation. There was a rose-colored sheet against my cheek. My sheets, the sheets I woke up to every day in my little bed, were not rose-colored, and they didn't smell like this. The mattress seemed too spacious to be my modest trundle bed. And really, I was quite sure this was not my headache either.
"Good morning, handsome,"
said a voice somewhere over my feet. I turned my head and saw Rita standing at the foot of the bed, looking down at me with a happy little smile. "Ugh," I said in a voice that sounded like a toad's croak and hurt my head even more. But apparently it was an amusing kind of pain, because Rita's smile widened.
"That's what I thought," she said. "I'll get you some aspirin."
She leaned over and rubbed my leg.
"Hmm," she said,
and then turned and went into the bathroom. I sat up. This may have been a strategic mistake, as it made my head pound a great deal more. I closed my eyes, breathed deeply, and waited for my aspirin. This normal life was going to take a little getting used to. But oddly enough, it didn't. Not really. I found that if I limited myself to one or two beers, I could relax just enough to blend in with the slipcover on the couch. And so several nights a week, with ever-faithful Sergeant Doakes in my rear-view mirror, I would stop over at Rita's house after work, play with Cody and Aster, and sit with Rita after the kids were in bed. Around 10, I would head for the door. Rita seemed to expect to be kissed when I left, so I generally arranged to kiss her standing in the open front door where Doakes could see me. I used all the technique I could muster from the many movies I have seen, and Rita responded happily. I do like routine, and I settled into this new one to a point where I almost began to believe in it myself. It was so boring that I was putting my real self to sleep. From far away in the back seat of the deepest, darkest corner of Dexterland, I could even hear the dark passenger starting to snore gently, which was a little scary and made me feel a tiny bit lonesome for the first time. But I stayed the course, making a small game of my visits to Rita to see how far I could push it, knowing that Doakes was watching and, hopefully, beginning to wonder just a little bit. I brought flowers, candy, and pizza. I kissed Rita ever more outlandishly, framed in the open front door to give Doakes the best possible picture. I knew it was a ridiculous display, but it was the only weapon I had. For days on end, Doakes stayed with me. His appearances were unpredictable, which made him seem even more threatening. I never knew when or where he might turn up, and that made me feel like he was always there. If I went into the grocery store, Doakes was waiting by the broccoli. If I rode my bicycle out Old Cutler Road, somewhere along the way I would see the maroon Taurus parked under a banyan tree. A day might go by without a Doakes sighting, but I could feel him out there, circling downwind and waiting. I didn't dare hope that he had given up. If I couldn't see him, he was either well hidden or waiting to spring another surprise appearance on me. I was forced into being daytime Dexter on a full-time basis, like an actor trapped in a movie, knowing that the real world was right there, just beyond the screen, but as unreachable as the moon. And like the moon, the thought of Riker pulled at me. The thought of him clomping through his unworried life in those absurd red boots was almost more than I could stand. Of course, I knew that even Doakes couldn't keep this up forever. He was, after all, receiving a handsome salary from the people of Miami for performing a job, and every now and then he had to perform it. But Doakes understood the rising interior tide that battered at me, and he knew that if he kept the pressure on long enough, the disguise would slip, had to slip, as the cool whispers from the back seat became more urgent. And so there we were, balanced on a knife edge that was unfortunately only metaphorical. Sooner or later, I had to be me. But until then, I would see an awful lot of Rita. She couldn't hold a candle to my old flame, the dark passenger, but I did need my secret identity. And until I escaped Doakes, Rita was my cape, red tights, and utility belt. Almost the entire costume. Very well. I would sit on the couch, can of beer in hand, watching Survivor and thinking of an interesting variation of the game that would never make it to the network. If you simply add Dexter to the castaways and interpret the title a bit more literally... It was not all dismal, bleak, and wretched. Several times a week I got to play kick the can with Cody and Aster and the other assorted wild creatures of the neighborhood. Which brings us back to where we began. Dexter dismasted, unable to sail through his normal life, anchored instead to a gaggle of kids and a ravioli can. And on evenings when it was raining, we stayed inside, around the dining table, while Rita bustled about doing laundry, washing dishes, and otherwise perfecting the domestic bliss of her little nest.
There are only so many indoor games one can play with two children of such tender ages and damaged spirits as Cody and Aster. Most of the board games were uninteresting or incomprehensible to them, and too many of the card games seemed to require a light-hearted simple-mindedness that even I could not fake convincingly. But we finally hit on Hangman. It was educational, creative, and mildly homicidal, which made everyone happy, even Rita. If you had asked me pre-Dokes if a life of Hangman and Miller Lite sounded like my cup of tea, I would have been forced to confess that Dexter Oolong was somewhat darker. But as the days piled up and I slipped further into the reality of my disguise, I had to ask myself, was I enjoying the life of Mr. Suburban Householder just a little too much? Still, it was very comforting somehow to see the predatory zest Cody and Aster brought to something as harmless as Hangman. Their enthusiasm for hanging the little stick figures made me feel a bit more like we might all be part of the same general species. As they happily murdered their anonymous hanged men, I felt a certain kinship. Aster quickly learned to draw the gallows and the lines for the letters. She was, of course, much more verbal about it. 7 letters, she would say, then tucking her upper lip between her teeth, add, wait, 6. As Cody and I missed on our guesses, she would pounce and call out, an arm, ha! Cody would stare at her without expression, and then look down to the doodled figure hanging from its noose. When it was his turn and we missed a guess, he would say in his soft voice, leg, and look up at us with something that might almost have been triumph in someone who showed emotion. And when the line of dashes under the gallows was finally filled in with the spelled-out word, they would both look at the dangling man with satisfaction. And once or twice, Cody even said, dead, before Aster bounced up and down and said, again, Dexter, my turn. All very idyllic. Our perfect little family of Rita, the kids, and Monster makes 4. But no matter how many stick figures we executed, it did nothing to kill my worry that time was gurgling rapidly down the drain, and soon I would be a white-haired old man, too feeble to lift a carving knife, tottering through my horrifyingly ordinary days, shadowed by an ancient Sergeant Dokes and a sense of missed opportunity. As long as I couldn't think of a way out, I was in the noose as surely as Cody and Aster's stick figures. Very depressing, and I am ashamed to admit that I almost lost hope, which I never would have done if I had remembered one important thing. This was Miami. Chapter 7. Of course it couldn't last. I should have known that such an unnatural state of affairs had to give way, yield to the natural order of things. After all, I lived in a city where mayhem was like the sunshine, always right behind the next cloud. 3 weeks after my first unsettling encounter with Sergeant Dokes, the clouds finally broke. It was just a piece of luck, really. Not quite the falling piano I had been hoping for, but still a happy coincidence. I was having lunch with my sister, Deborah. Excuse me, I should have said Sergeant Deborah. Like her father, Harry, Debs was a cop. Owing to the happy outcome of recent events, she had been promoted, pulled out of the prostitute costume she had been forced to wear by her assignment with Vice, whisked off the street corner at last, and into her very own set of sergeant's stripes. It should have made her happy. After all, this was what she thought she wanted, an end to her tenure as a pretend hooker. Any young and reasonably attractive female officer assigned to Vice would sooner or later find herself in a prostitution sting operation,
and Deborah was very attractive. But her lush figure and healthy good looks had never done anything for my poor sister except embarrass her. She hated to wear anything that even hinted at her physical charms, and standing on the street in hot pants and a tube top had been sheer torture for her. She had been in danger of growing permanent frown lines. Because I am an inhuman monster, I tend to be logical, and I had thought that her new assignment would end her martyrdom as Our Lady of Perpetual Grumpiness. Alas, even her transfer to homicide had failed to bring a smile to her face. Somewhere along the way, she had decided that serious law enforcement personnel must reshape their faces until they looked like large, mean-spirited fish, and she was still working very hard to accomplish this. We had come to lunch together in her new motor pool car, another of the perks of her promotion that really should have brought a small ray of sunshine into her life. It didn't seem to. I wondered if I should worry about her. I watched her as I slid into a booth at Café Relámpago, our favorite Cuban restaurant. She called in her location and status, and then sat across from me, with a frown. "Well, Sergeant Grouper," I said as we picked up our menus. "Is that funny, Dexter?" "Yes," I said. "Very funny."
"And a little sad, too. Like life itself. Especially your life, Deborah."
"Fuck you, Charlie," she said. "My life is fine." And to prove it, she ordered a medianoche sandwich, the best in Miami, and a batido de mame, a milkshake made from a unique tropical fruit that tastes something like a combination of peach and watermelon. My life was every bit as fine as hers, so I ordered the same thing. Because we are regulars here and had been coming here most of our lives, the aging, unshaven waiter snatched away our menus with a face that might have been the role model for Deborah's and stomped off to the kitchen like Godzilla on his way to Tokyo.
"Everyone is so cheerful and happy," I said. "This isn't Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, Dex. It's Miami. Only the bad guys are happy."
She looked at me without expression, a perfect cop stare.
"How come you're not laughing and singing?"
"Unkind, Deb. Very unkind. I've been good for months." She took a sip of water.
"Uh-huh. And it's making you crazy."
"Much worse than that," I said with a shudder. "I think it's making me normal."
"Could have fooled me," she said.
"Sad but true. I've become a couch potato." I hesitated, then blurted it out. "After all, if a boy can't share his problems with his family, who can he confide in?"
"It's Sergeant Doakes," I said. She nodded. "He's got a real hard-on for you," she said. "You better keep away from him."
"I would love to," I said, "but he won't keep away from me."
Her cop stare got harder. "What do you plan to do about it?"
I opened my mouth to deny all the things I had been thinking, but happily, for the good of my immortal soul, before I could lie to her, we were interrupted by the sound of Deb's radio. She cocked her head to one side, snatched up the radio, and said she was on her way.
"Come on," she snapped, heading for the door.
I followed meekly behind, pausing only to throw some money on the table. Deborah was already backing out her car by the time I came out of Relámpago's. I hurried over and lunged for the door. She was moving forward and out of the parking lot before I even got both feet in.
"Really, Deb," I said, "I almost lost a shoe. What's so important?"
Deborah frowned, accelerating through a small gap in traffic that only a Miami driver would have attempted.
"I don't know," she said as she turned on the siren.
I blinked and raised my voice over the noise.
"Didn't the dispatcher tell you?" "Have you ever heard the dispatcher stutter, Dexter?"
"Why, no, Deb, I haven't. Did this one do that?" Deb swerved around a school bus and roared up onto 836.
"Yeah," she said.
She turned hard to avoid a BMW full of young men, who all flipped her off.
"I think it's a homicide."
"You think?" I said.
"Yeah," she answered,
and then she concentrated on driving, and I let her.
High speeds always remind me of my own mortality, especially on Miami's roads. And as for the case of the stuttering dispatcher, well, Sergeant Nancy Drew and I would find out soon enough, particularly at this speed. And a little excitement is always welcome. In a very few minutes, Deb managed to get us over near the Orange Bowl without causing major loss of life, and we came down onto the surface roads and made a few quick turns before sliding into the curb at a small house on Northwest 4th Street. The street was lined with similar houses, all small and close together, and each one with its own wall or chain-link fence. Many of them were brightly colored and had paved yards. Two patrol cars had already pulled up in front of the house, their lights flashing. A pair of uniformed cops were rolling out the yellow crime scene tape around the place, and as we got out, I saw a third cop sitting in the front seat of one of the cars, his head in his hands. On the porch of the house, a fourth cop stood beside an elderly lady. There were two small steps leading up to the porch, and she sat on the top one. She seemed to be alternating weeping with throwing up. Somewhere nearby, a dog was howling, the same note over and over. Deborah marched up to the nearest uniform. He was a square, middle-aged guy with dark hair and a look on his face that said he wished he was sitting in his car with his head in his hands, too. "What have we got?" Deb asked him, holding up her badge. The cop shook his head without looking at us and blurted out, "I'm not going in there again, not if it costs me my pension." And he turned away, almost walking into the side of a patrol car, rolling out the yellow tape like it could protect him from whatever was in the house. Deborah stared after the cop, then looked at me. Quite frankly, I could think of nothing really useful or clever to say, and for a moment we just stood there looking at each other. The wind rattled the crime scene tape, and the dog continued to howl. A kind of weird yodeling sound that did nothing to increase my affection for the canine species. Deborah shook her head. "Somebody should shut that fucking dog up," she said, and she ducked under the yellow tape and started up the walk to the house. I followed. After a few steps, I realized that the dog sound was getting closer. It was in the house, probably the victim's pet. Quite often an animal reacts badly to its owner's death. We stopped at the steps and Deborah looked up at the cop, reading his name tag. "Coronel, is this lady a witness?" The cop didn't look at us. "Yeah," he said. "Mrs. Medina. She called it in." And the old woman leaned over and retched. Deborah frowned. "What's with that dog?" she asked him. Coronel made a sort of barking noise halfway between laughing and gagging, but he didn't answer, and he didn't look at us. I suppose Deborah had had enough, and it's hard to blame her. "What the fuck is going on here?" she demanded. Coronel turned his head to look at us. There was no expression at all on his face. "See for yourself," he said, and then he turned away again. Deborah thought she was going to say something, but changed her mind. She looked at me instead and shrugged. "We might as well take a look," I told her, and I hoped I didn't sound too eager. In truth, I was anxious to see anything that could create this kind of reaction in Miami cops. Sergeant Doakes might very well prevent me from doing anything on my own, but he couldn't stop me from admiring someone else's creativity. After all, it was my job, and shouldn't we enjoy our work? Deborah, on the other hand, showed uncharacteristic reluctance. She glanced back at the patrol car where the cop still sat, unmoving, head in hands. Then she looked back to Coronel and the old lady. Then at the front door of the little house. She took a deep breath, blew it out hard, and said, "All right, let's have a look." But she still didn't move, so I slipped past her and pushed open the door. The front room of the little house was dark, curtains and blinds all pulled closed. There was one easy chair that looked like it had come from a thrift shop. It had a slipcover that was so dirty it was impossible to tell what color it was supposed to be. The chair sat in front of a small TV on a folding card table. Other than that, the room was empty. The doorway opposite the front door showed a small patch of light, and that seemed to be where the dog was yowling, so I headed that way, toward the back of the house. Animals don't like me, which proves they are smarter than we think. They seem to sense what I am, and they disapprove, often expressing their opinion in a very pointed way. So I was a little bit reluctant to approach a dog already so obviously upset. But I moved through the doorway slowly, calling out hopefully, "Nice doggy!" It didn't really sound like a very nice doggy. It sounded like a brain-damaged pit bull with rabies. But I do try to put a good face on things, even with our canine friends. With a kind and animal-loving expression on my face, I stepped to the swinging door that led to what was obviously the kitchen. As I touched the door, I heard a soft and uneasy rustling from the dark passenger, and I paused. "What?" I asked, but there was no reply. I closed my eyes for just a second, but the page was blank. No secret message flashed onto the back of my eyelids. I shrugged, pushed open the door, and stepped into the kitchen. The upper half of the room was painted a faded, greasy yellow, and the lower half was lined with old blue pinstriped white tiles. There was a small refrigerator in one corner and a hot plate on the counter. A palmetto bug ran across the counter and dove.